You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Life in Wisconsin has transformed since Governor Tony Evers declared a public health emergency on March 12th. Businesses are shuttered across the state while public health officials urge people to stay home. But some businesses continue, and that includes the filing of medical debt lawsuits against patients. Bram Sable-Smith reports.
Blanche Jordan is taking social distancing seriously. When she's not at work as a caregiver at an assisted living facility near Milwaukee, she's at home, likely playing one of the games she has to pass the time. On Sunday night at 8 p.m., she was starting a 1,000-piece Game of Thrones puzzle on her living room floor.
And I get this doorbell, and, you know, I put my mask and stuff on, and I go to the door, and gives me this paper and talking about you've been served. I'm like, what the hell?
Yes. Someone showed up at her house on a Sunday evening during the pandemic with a stay-at-home order in effect to serve her with a $7,000 lawsuit from Frederick Hospital in Milwaukee.
This lady came to my door. She didn't have a mask on. She didn't have gloves. Not saying gloves would have made a difference, but unmasked. And she looking at me like I'm crazy because I got a whole mask across my face.
This is not the first time Jordan's incurred medical debt. Her bills from breast cancer treatment led her to declare bankruptcy in 2017. She's in remission now, by the way. Plus, she just paid off a different $5,000 debt to Frederick. That was for a hysterectomy she didn't realize would not be covered by her insurance.
I did give them my insurance card. They ran it.
But no one told her they did not accept it. Jordan thinks the new debt she's being sued over might be the remainder of the hysterectomy bill. But she says it's scary to get served during a pandemic. Yet, an analysis by WPR and Wisconsin Watch found at least 104 small claim suits filed by Wisconsin hospitals since March 12th, the day Governor Tony Evers declared a public health emergency. Jessica Roulette's an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin.
I think the COVID-19 pandemic has presented particular problems for collection of medical debt through the court system.
Roulette says there are practices in the court system that are at odds with public health best practices, like serving papers in person and statute of limitation deadlines to file lawsuits.
I would also hope that to some extent, the people who are owed money are able to show a little grace.
A spokesperson for Frederick says they suspended filing small claim suits on March 18th. Jordan's case was filed before that. But court records show at least 18 small claim suits have been filed on the hospital's behalf since then, including 15 yesterday. Spokespeople from UW Health, Gunderson, Aspirus, and Marshfield Clinic all told WPR they've suspended small claim suits during the pandemic. Ongoing suits like Jordan's are in a murkier area. Bobby Peterson is executive director of the public interest law firm ABC Health.
It's a disconnect between, you know, the hospital and the law firms that they've retained to pursue these issues.
He says hospitals need to do a better job of communicating their policies to those law firms. Getting sued by a hospital over an unpaid medical bill is stressful under even normal circumstances. This pandemic, Peterson says, is a whole new ballgame.
We're seeing massive amounts of dislocated workers who are losing their jobs and in many cases their health insurance coverage.
Meanwhile, Blanche Jordan's day in court has been postponed due to the new coronavirus. She says it's frustrating.
Which is it? Do you want to sue me or do you want to wait?
For now, she'll keep staying home, likely playing games to pass the time. Unless she's at work at the assisted living facility near Milwaukee. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now here on The Morning Show, we are talking about COVID-19. It is not an overstatement that we have changed our way of life right now as we try to prevent the spread. And your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about preventing or trying to avoid the new coronavirus? What do you wonder about cleaning or social distancing? What are you experiencing? Are you worried about what to do if you start showing symptoms? Let us know what questions you have about the illness and how to handle it at 800-642-1234. 1234. You have a line right now at 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Mary Beth Graham, who is an internal medicine and infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, joining us. She specializes in infections in immunocompromised individuals and influenza treatment and prevention, also the prevention and transmission of hospital-associated infections. Dr. Graham, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
You know, COVID-19, this disease caused by the new coronavirus, has now been confirmed in two-thirds of Wisconsin's counties. What can we definitively say is part of the process of this virus spreading?
So, I mean, like any respiratory virus, when we look at seasonal respiratory viruses, the normal human coronaviruses, rhinoviruses, influenza, I don't mean to be too technical. It's a droplet spread person to person. So it's either on the hands of an infected individual, it's on an infected surface that somebody has touched, that somebody else touches, and they touch their face or their mouth, or it's within that 6 feet of being with somebody who's coughing or sneezing because of those droplets that can go about that distance, and then people breathe them in. That's basically the primary way that it's spread.
It seems like this is spreading quickly. Is that accurate, or is that our perception?
So there's a lot of testing that is being done out there. I mean, the thing is that in the state we're seeing more and more cases, but pretty much at our hospital, it's about, of the people that we test, it's about 12% of the people who are tested are testing positive. Compare that to when we were at the height of influenza season, we were checking, it was up 30-35% of people that were being tested for influenza were testing positive. We expect that percentage to increase. The thing about coronavirus, though, about this this specific coronavirus, is that not everybody has the same set of symptoms, whereas influenza's fairly classic, with an acute onset of a fever, body aches, chills, et cetera. Coronavirus can present in a number of different ways. Many people we're now finding out are asymptomatic. They don't have really any symptoms, or may have mild runny nose or a little bit of a sore throat, but not much of anything else. There are some reports of people presenting initially with more GI symptoms, with nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. We don't see that with influenza. We need more data. I mean, the thing right now that we're working off of, and pretty much everybody in the country is working off of, is that we're using anecdotes of what we've seen and what the presentations are to try to get more information about what should we look for. There were reports that some people were presenting saying that they had an alteration in their taste sensation, but that was one report. So it's confusing to providers, and I'm sure it's confusing to the public because things keep changing out there in the media. What we need is over time is to look at all of these factors, take time to look back at them over time and say, okay, what exactly are those presenting symptoms? What things can we count on? When should we consider, et cetera? Anecdotes, as I tell my trainees, because I work with a lot of residents and fellows at the Medical College of Wisconsin, anecdotes, the plural of anecdotes isn't data. So there needs to be a lot done. And so we're asking for patience. We know a lot of people are upset that, why don't you know this right now? And there's not enough information to get to that point.
Dr. Mary Beth Graham stays with us. She's the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Frederick Hospital. And we want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234. What do you need to know about keeping safe and healthy right now? What information do you need to understand about trying to prevent this new coronavirus? Is someone in your family someone with a compromised immune system? What concerns do you have right now for the people who are most vulnerable? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. Wisconsin has more than 1,300 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and health experts expect that number to go up. Early on, some people likened the new coronavirus to influenza. And the more we learn about the disease, the more that comparison doesn't really hold up. We're learning more from an infectious disease expert here on The Morning Show. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. And you can join in with your questions for Dr. Mary Beth Graham at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the spread of COVID-19. Graham is the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Frederick Hospital. And Dr. Graham, you also study influenza, and help us understand how COVID-19's virus is different from the seasonal flu that we talk about, because there were many comparisons to that, especially in the beginning.
So the reason that there were a lot of comparisons is that, again, they spread similarly by droplet transmission. Influenza and coronaviruses are in totally different classes of viruses. Their structure is different. Coronaviruses are kind of special. They're what we call enveloped viruses, such that they may be a little bit more hardy to exist on a surface rather than influenza for other things. Originally, we thought they wouldn't be as able to exist on a surface longer, but some of the newer reports out say that they can stay on, like, cardboard or plastic for a bit longer than what we thought that they would be able to. Influenza is very much a upper respiratory infection, can cause a pneumonia, but most of the time with influenza, we see a secondary bacterial pneumonia causing the problem. A primary influenza pneumonia, or influenza being in the lower part of the lung causing pneumonia, is much less common. This coronavirus is different. The human coronaviruses that normally circulate, which cause the common cold, all exist up in the nose and the throat. And when we look at the SARS and the MERS, the other coronaviruses that now SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 are more similar to those, they liked to hang out in the lower lung. And that's why there was such a significant, you saw a lot more problems with pneumonias and actually deaths from pneumonia with those. This one is kind of in between. It likes both places. It likes your upper nose and respiratory tract and can hang out there and cause symptoms as, you know, again, as mild as a common cold, or it can get down into your lower respiratory tract and cause a pneumonia. And when it causes a pneumonia, the immune response that the body makes to it is what is leading to a lot of the problems that we've seen with patients who end up on ventilators. We call it ARDS, where the lung essentially, there's a response in the lung where the body's making certain substances, it's going after it, it's trying to fight it, but in your body's process of trying to fight it, it also causes lung damage. So this virus is very, very different than what we saw with SARS and MERS. It's very different than the circulating coronaviruses. It is different than influenza because it can do both, and it seems to do both. Again, over time, we'll figure out what the balance is. Does it like more the upper respiratory tract or the lower? We're only going to know that down the line when we're able to do more types of testing.
More time, more information gathering,
more,
for sure.
More time, yeah. More information. I think the thing that'll be very telling is with every type of new infection, sometimes they go back and they'll do what we call antibody testing. Antibody testing right now really doesn't give us much information. But down the line, from an epidemiology standpoint, we can do what are called seroseveys and then look back and say, oh, my, this many people actually are positive for this, and they were probably asymptomatic and didn't have it. There's going to be a lot coming out about this over the next year or two or more.
And we are talking with Dr. Mary Beth Graham, who's an infectious disease expert and specializes in influenza treatment and prevention. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the spread of COVID-19. And Mary from Pewaukee wants to join us now. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning to you and your guests. I have actually a three-parter, and it's probably, like you just said, that you won't know for the next year or two possibly. But in your testing, when might we find out if you can actually get it twice, as some people, you know, can get the flu twice, maybe this year and then, you know, down the road. The second part would be, might it ever be erased from the earth? And the third is, if it does, could it come back actually even worse, which my husband kind of presented as a nurse, but...
Okay. Mary, thanks for those questions for sure. Dr. Mary Beth, we're hearing a theme of recurrence there with Mary.
So the issue of getting it twice, that's a really interesting question, because what's been published just recently is that in China, they've gone back and they've been screening people who in Wuhan who were previously positive and totally recovered, and they've screened them and their nose swabs are still positive. And the question has come up, did they get it again, or are they carriers of this? That's a big question. It's a huge question that we don't know yet. There are many of the normal respiratory viruses that we see, like rhinovirus and the other, again, human coronaviruses that we see just every single year. People can carry those sometimes in their upper respiratory tract and essentially be asymptomatic. How well you would actually spread that to somebody else is really thought to not be significant, because if you're not coughing or sneezing or et cetera, then you shouldn't be able to spread it. But can you get it twice? Big question. We don't think the antibody response that people, so when people get exposed to an infectious agent, one of the ways that your body protects you from getting it again is it makes an antibody response. That's why we give people immunizations. Like with influenza, we give you a vaccine so that you make antibodies against influenza. And then that helps protect you against influenza. There's also a lot of data out there about the variability on some people making robust antibody responses versus not making robust antibody responses. Again, more data needs to come out. So I don't know the answer to that, but most of the stuff I've seen about quote unquote people getting it twice is just because they've swabbed, their swabs are still positive, but it seems like people have no symptoms at that time.
The answer to a lot of these things, because it is a brand new virus to the human body, you know, will be an issue of waiting. We've got Doreen in Weston who also has a question. Good morning, Doreen.
It's Doreen, but thanks.
Good morning, I'm sorry, Doreen. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. Doreen the bathtub. Good April Fool's. I wish it all was an April Fool's thing. I heard three things. China said that they noticed people with type O blood was less likely to get it, and if they did get it, it was less severe, not 100% of the cases, and this was over type A. And also, I heard it has less chance to mutate to different strains like the regular flu. So if they do a vaccine, will it be a type like where they incorporate it with the flu shot, or will it be a standalone shot you'd have to get every year, or once? It's just more like the measles where you get it when you're a kid and you're good to go. Those were a few of my questions.
Okay. So number one, you taught me something. I didn't know about the type O and the type A blood, so now I'm going to have to Google that as soon as I'm off the line. There's so much coming out, so I had not heard that. So I apologize. I cannot respond on that one. With regards to mutation of this particular virus, I mean, right now they've already reported that there are, as they've cloned out or grown the virus, like either in South Korea or in Singapore, et cetera, that there are minor differences between the viruses that are of the SARS-CoV-2, but they're not enough to actually make them significantly different. So whereas influenza, again, during the year, the flu can change itself, but then it can make these big shifts. I'm not 100% sure whether coronaviruses don't seem to be similar in that fact, but again, I don't have a crystal ball on that one. The thing with the vaccine, one of the concerns about vaccine is you've got to find something. Is there something about the coronavirus that is a stable part of that virus, which so that you can make a vaccine that would be kind of universal to all coronaviruses, whether it's the human ones that cause the common cold versus the other. Influenza changes so much. That's why you have to get the flu shot every year, because it's a different type of influenza that we'll see each year. They change enough so that the vaccine from the previous year isn't going to work. Coronaviruses, we don't think that will be the case, but again, we can't guarantee that that will be the case.
Right. And Dr. Mary Beth Graham, I'm so sorry that we have to stop here, but we have so many questions for you and would love to have you back. Thank you so much for doing a little bit of myth busting and catching us up here as we try to navigate this new coronavirus. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is an internal medicine and infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we are taking more questions, this time about public policy when it comes to COVID-19. How do you think private industry and government leaders can work together? What should we be doing as a whole? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. News is next. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has sent a letter to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He's asking President Donald Trump to issue a major disaster declaration for the entire state because of COVID-19. It's just one piece of the complicated, evolving, and sometimes disjointed response from public officials as they try to manage the fallout from a new illness the human body has never encountered before. We're talking about public policy, and we want your take. What actions do you want to see from government officials? What kind of a national response do we need right now? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. The number again, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Andy Slavik founded the United States of Care think tank, where he advises state and national leaders on healthcare policy. That includes the recent federal coronavirus relief bill. He also started the Stay Home, Save Lives public health campaign along with healthcare leaders across the country. And he was the acting administrator for the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services during the Obama administration. Andy, thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Glad to be here.
You have outlined 20 priorities that should be that should govern the national response to the coronavirus pandemic. A few of them: save every life possible, protect frontline care workers, create a national testing leadership team. What's the most important thing for the federal government to be doing right now?
Well, the reason that this is so important is because I think more than ever in a crisis, people are ready to follow a government that they trust, that puts forward honest data, and that can help them lead. I think having competent people, scientists, drive decisions is what we'd like to see. And then taking bold action to make sure that we are protecting our frontline workforce, that we are making sure that we are protecting our most vulnerable populations, that can be done with much stronger federal action. I applaud Governor Evers and many other governors who are taking on some of those things on their own, but it's much, much easier when it's being pushed federally. He said a week ago that he'd like to be seen as a wartime president, and I think that's indeed something that I think we'd all like to see, but that means arming your frontline troops. It means reading the battle maps. It means being highly skeptical of good news. It means driving quick decisions and results in concert with the governors in this country. So hopefully that's where we're going to head.
Yeah, but how do you balance all of those priorities? I mean, they can't all be number one.
Well, in wartime, we didn't just fight battles in one front in World War II. We can have our scientists working on vaccines and therapies and new testing at the same time that we have our manufacturing capacity, increasing ventilator production, that we can have our military operations in FEMA move ventilators where they need to be. This is a massive federal government. I know we have an administration that has been distrustful of the lifelong public servants that serve across the government. But if you get them motivated and you get them activated and you combine them with the work that's done at the state and federal, the state and local level, we can get a lot more done.
You're in touch with the White House, with hospital CEOs, research institutions, medical labs, all at the forefront of this crisis. So how are you trying to bring people together just each day? What's it look like?
You know, I think everybody knows we're going through a time that is at least unprecedented in our history. And we're going to get through it. It's going to be rough. It's going to be painful. But we are, the vast majority of us are going to get through it. The only question is, what will be the casualty count? And what will we have done? What will we look back on and say we were doing during this time? How much were we helping? How much were we fighting? So I'm no different than anybody else, except I have perhaps the privilege of having access, given my former roles, and the fact that I'm willing to take aggressive actions and help people take aggressive actions. Because in a time of crisis, speed is more important than perfection. And, you know, I've led a major national, or led our way out of a pretty major national crisis before, although I think this one is worse. And so those things are the things that, you know, I know we need to do. And while I've never been counted as a Donald Trump fan, I'm very much on the side of anybody who is trying to get results now. I don't think now is a good time for politics, but I think now is a good time for pulling together.
Andy Slavik advises state and national leaders on healthcare policy, and we're talking about coordinating responses to the COVID-19 outbreak. And you're part of this conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Where do you see leadership right now? What do you think needs to happen to save lives? How are you balancing some of these ideas like freedom and economics in the middle of a public health crisis? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email us your experiences or your questions at ideas@WPR.org. Andy, across the country, healthcare workers are pleading for basic medical supplies to stay safe. Gloves, gowns, masks. We've seen in China and Italy, especially, doctors and nurses are dying. And Wisconsin's getting its second shipment of supplies from the federal government now, but it's kind of piecemeal. What needs to happen, and how does the private sector play into that?
Yeah. Look, I think the great thing about these times is leadership emerges in all kinds of places. You know, in Wisconsin, I read the announcement from Governor Evers the other day about the work being done by Exact Sciences and Wisconsin University, University of Wisconsin, Madison, and others to pull together to create test production. We are, I think, quickly seeing and fleshing out where we're quickly seeing and fleshing out all the places where there are masks that are going out of the country and going other places that need to stay in the country. We're seeing volunteerism and people at a level that are at the level where they should be. They're doing things that are just unbelievable. They're doing babysitting for the people who are frontline healthcare workers. They're volunteering in all kinds of extraordinary ways. So the country's response is going to be at its best when everybody, from the biotech community to individuals and communities to all other kinds of places, are doing whatever the things that they can. And I think this ingenuity is going to get us out of this.
You know, earlier you mentioned that you advocate for policy at the federal level, for guidance at the federal level, to provide that consistency across states. But we're seeing still some states without shelter in place or stay at home orders. And we're also seeing varying degrees based on different local and state leaders. Do you think we need a mandatory federal lockdown to stem the spread of COVID-19?
Well, National Geographic came out with a very interesting study, showed how each city across the country responded to the 1918 flu. And what's interesting about it, and I encourage people who are interested to get their hands on it, is it shows the social distancing measures taken in each city, and it shows what happened to the death rate in each city based upon the social distancing. And that flu, which is obviously different than this current case, but also had highly infectious, was highly infectious, killed a lot of people. The differences in cities based upon how early they started social distancing and how long they kept it was about 2 to 1. You could have twice as many deaths, for example, per person in San Francisco than you did in Minneapolis, which was the lowest. And that had everything to do with what all of us did. It had less to do with the government and had more to do with how much we could sustain this focus. So the thing is, there is a right answer. Now, that right answer is hard. That right answer is not what everybody wants to hear. We'd all love to go out and spend the spring with our friends and our family, and we'd all like to be back on the job, working, feeling less insecure about our incomes and so forth. But the 1918 flu passed, but it only passed when the disease stopped spreading. And in this case, we're going to need to take these actions until we have both therapies and a vaccine.
So, I mean, we already have even politicians, not just business leaders, but politicians speaking out and saying specifically Wisconsin cannot stay under this stay-at-home order forever. But we are looking at a significant amount of time. I mean, how long would we have to work together government-wise to make sure that we could try to stem this? Do we have any idea?
So there's people who've made estimates. Bill Gates has said that it could be 6 to 10 weeks. And you know, Bill Gates is a very smart person. But the best answer is that it's really dependent upon a couple of factors. And I think this is what everyone has to figure out together. The first is we need to see declining day-to-day and week-to-week caseloads. So as long as community-based caseloads are going up, then ending the social distancing and the social isolation would be a really significantly bad idea for the number of people infected and the number of people who die. So that's, I think, that's important. Second thing is we need to have the ability to have rapid testing and contact tracing all across the community. If we can do that, then we have the ability to make sure that we don't have a massive outbreak again.
And let's hit pause on that, because we will get into more about rapid testing and what that could mean for how we're handling this new COVID-19 outbreak in just a moment. And we continue talking with Andy Slavik, the former head of Medicare and Medicaid during the Obama administration. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We want to know if you think that lockdowns are necessary, or if for some reason you don't think that's the right way for us to handle it. What do you think about widespread testing or monitoring for and enforcing social distancing measures? Is it working in your community? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 to let us know what you think the federal government should be doing now. I'm Keely Boltina. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. The coronavirus pandemic has highlighted the need for medical and scientific leadership across the country. Doctors and nurses are working overtime. Virologists and epidemiologists are coordinating research and data and hunting for solutions. And across the country, mayors and governors are scrambling to make public health decisions. Leaders are coming out of the woodwork. Our guest is Andy Slavik. He formerly worked as a healthcare leader for the federal government running Medicare, and now he's advising politicians on how to manage this unprecedented health crisis. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What should the federal government be doing now? Do you think we need a national lockdown to save lives? Or is it better for states or communities to make those decisions? What do you think coordination would look like between the private sector to ramp up production for medical supplies and the government? Whose responsibility is it? We're at 800-642-1234. Andy, you were talking about just a moment ago about the idea of rapid testing. We know that Abbott Labs produces medical products. Company says it could soon be able to make 50,000 coronavirus tests a day, tests that can return results in a matter of minutes. Some places are still waiting days for results. Will this change our entire understanding of the scope and spread of the virus?
My understanding is that we're going to have tests that are better and better and better. As I mentioned, there's a company in Wisconsin that's converted lab space to start making a large amount of tests. That's Exact Sciences in Madison. The Abbott test sounds like a game changer, and I've not talked to Abbott. The people I know that have are pretty excited. I think getting the ability to test rapidly is very, very important. The other thing that is important is a different type of test, which people refer to as an antibody test, which is a test to see whether or not someone has built up immunity. In other words, whether they've had COVID-19 in the past. When those tests are available, that is a different type of test. It requires a pinprick of blood. Once those tests are rapidly available, we'll actually begin to understand how many people actually have had COVID-19 and have built up immunity. Some people suspect that a lot of people have had it and don't know it. And that we'll be able to have those people out in society working and being able to do those things much more quickly. So those things are not far, far away, and they're critically important, along with what people call contact tracing, which is even if you do go out and we begin to open up the economy again, which I know people desperately need, that we're very, very careful about who we come in contact with. We keep the 6 feet distance measures in place for a while. And we remember who we talked to and connected with, because we have to contain anything that begins to break out again.
All right. We're talking with Andy Slavik, who recently launched the Stay Home, Save Lives public health campaign, along with other healthcare leaders across the country. And we're discussing public policy when it comes to the coronavirus outbreak. And we have Katie from Janesville ready to join the conversation. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Good morning. And thanks for taking my call. You had asked earlier as to whether we needed a national lockdown. I do not believe that we need a national one. I do believe that the states can handle that on their own, as some of them have been setting up checkpoints along their borders. If we have different states that are supposed to be peaking here this week, and we have others that aren't supposed to peak until July, if we have a national lockdown, those states that are further down the curve, we're really going to be hurting on the economy, on the individual people. Some of those states have more land than they have people, so they already are social distancing anyway. But I do believe that the states themselves can handle a lot of that, with federal guidelines, of course. But let the states do it, not a national one.
All right, Katie, thanks for that perspective. And Andy, Katie's saying, sure, federal guidance is good, but we have to keep control at the local level when it comes to, restricting people's movements.
Katie's very, very smart about this issue, and what she's saying makes a lot of sense. Southern Italy and Northern Italy, things hit it at different times. There's two challenges, however, with that, which makes it difficult. One is that it turns out that days and weeks of starting when you start has enormous difference on the overall death rate. And states don't always know. So we have to have the ability, given that people still travel around this country, we have to have the ability, if a state is not acting when the CDC or others see the data that tell us when to take action, that the federal government should be able to overrule, because there are states right now and governors right now who are really not taking this as seriously as Governor Evers. And to take Florida as a well-known example, there are people that go down to Florida, whether they're snowbirds from Wisconsin or whether they're high schoolers or teenagers, and Wisconsin, a lot of the spread that has come to places like Wisconsin and to Minnesota and other places has in fact come from that kind of travel. State putting restrictions at state borders doesn't always help, because a lot of these, particularly high school and college age people, more than half of them don't have symptoms, so you couldn't even take their temperature. So it's a tricky question, and I agree that local conditions matter, but I also think that the federal government can't be afraid to play a stronger role.
Our election is next Tuesday, is Tuesday here in Wisconsin, and elections are a fundamental part of our functioning democracy. And yet it's a pandemic. Do you think public policy-wise we should be holding elections during the COVID-19 outbreak, or is it a dangerous precedent to set? Where do you fall?
I think we have to keep our democracy strong. I don't think this is – I don't think anybody would feel very good about removing some of the core underpinnings of who we are. I think we need to be able to find other ways of doing it in the year 2020. We can do it by mail. We can find other ways to do it. You know, it's part of a larger theme of things that I keep saying, which as much as possible, we need to be safe, but we need to go on with our lives, too. We can't be spending 24 hours obsessing about a virus that is going to make us miserable. It's already presenting economic challenges. It's already presenting, obviously, health challenges to families. We can't add to that, and particularly at a time when people have are distant from their loved ones and their friends, we have to find the things that we can do, and we have the ingenuity to do, and keep them going. And our democracy is a vital part of that.
And what do you say then to skeptics who think that all of these restrictions, the economic fallout, the mass panic, it's just overblowing something? It's not really the real threat.
I think you're hearing that less and less, and I think you're going to hear that less and less. Not that it'll go away at all. And there's merit to the point that the economic consequences of this are extremely challenging for people. So I have a lot of empathy for people who say that we're in a tough situation and there's going to be real damage from any extended ability to focus on these health issues. But we do know is that when people let up too early, and we know this from other countries, the Asian countries right now, and we know it from the 1918 flu, that it bounces right back, and it bounces back in a way that is can be as significant, can have as many people dying. So we're better off, even though it's painful, getting it all done at once, and then being able to move on. The skeptics, I think, are going to find, if they're really skeptical, I think they're learning every day, as I think President Trump has, that it's going to be hard to avoid the images we see on TV, the numbers that we see on TV, the images of hospitals. There's the kinds of things we haven't seen in this country, certainly in our lifetime. We maybe barely even see them overseas, and we see it during wartime. But when people see those images, I think it's going to be hard for people to be skeptical. They may still have an argument for how the damage works on the other side as well. But sadly, this is going to be a rough month for everybody.
Andy, thank you so much for your time today. Andy Slavik was the acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services from 2015 to 2017. His new podcast about the pandemic is called In the Bubble. I'm Keely Boltina. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network, and you can find the latest news and related stories to COVID-19 at our website. Just go to WPR.org/COVID. Good morning.